Chapter 12. Going North. Jamie managed not to touch the fruit for a week. By the end of that week, he was shaking with the cold as he rode, even huddled close to the neck of his steed, wrapped in layers of furs. He couldn't remember what it felt like to be warm. He couldn't remember the taste of Rob's mouth. His breath streamed away like his soul escaping out of his body and into the night, despite the veils he had wrapped over his face. He'd killed so many whites, he didn't remember the numbers anymore. The people in every house he reached urged him to stay. They told him he wouldn't live to reach the next one. He'd proved them wrong so far. But after one long stretch of riding, he'd reached the holdfast he'd been making for and found the house gone, burned almost down to the foundation and filled with charred corpses. Two dead men came at him over the ruins of the wall and attacked him. He destroyed them both, but his hands were so numb he barely felt the hilt of the sword, and the dragon glass slipped out of his hand and he had to club the second one away with a log until he could frantically scramble after it in the snow. Shivering in the dark by the small fire that he'd managed to get going in the single corner of the house that was dry, he knew that if he went to sleep, he wouldn't get up again. He took the box out with clumsy fingers and put some snow on to melt in a dented pot and poured a cup, and then took his dragon glass blade and poked a single hole in the skin of the fruit and let one red drop fall. It spread through the water, but not like ink. It made the whole cup a vivid, glowing red. He was desperate and frozen, but as soon as the hot charnel smell rose from the surface, he didn't want to drink it. It didn't smell anything like the cups that the riders had drunk from every night around him. He lifted it to his mouth and had to force his lips open, and then he had to pour it down his throat, fighting not to spew it back out. It was blood, and not even the blood of some freshly killed game. It was living blood, pulsing into him as if someone had put his mouth to an open vein. It slid over his tongue, viscous and thick and cloying, and as soon as he'd swallowed down the entire cup, he was heaving up the contents of his stomach, the bread and broth he'd eaten at the keep he'd left however many hours before. Everything came up without a trace of red, as if the drink had sunk into him some other way. And even as he knelt, still panting over the steaming vomit, spitting out misery, he was warm. He was warm all the way through, and he felt stronger, not weaker, even though he was sickened to the core. All around him, the world seemed almost bright as day, even though everything was still black and white and gray. He managed for another week, and then he had to take another drop. He tried using less water, but it was worse. He barely managed to choke down 5 swallows, and he was retching helplessly for half an hour afterwards. After that, he always used a full cup of water. Once he crossed the black water, walking over the solidly frozen river, he had to drink one every day, even if he also had a fire. The cold was growing deeper and more bitter the further north he went. And whenever he found living people, they barely moved or spoke. They huddled together at their hearths in groups, buried under coverings. And instead of saving them from dead men, he chopped firewood and piled it around them and brought them the frozen carcasses of deer and rabbits that he'd found as he traveled. He wasn't meeting any whites anymore. Even when he came to Lichyards, none of them came out of the ground. He didn't think they could have gotten out. The ground felt like solid ice underneath his feet, as if it had lost all memory of the sun. Even at the great keeps, everyone had retreated inward. The walls and towers were unmanned, and sometimes, even if there was a trail of smoke coming from a chimney somewhere inside, showing some sign of life, when he stood outside the gates and shouted, no one came. Those times, when he did get inside, through grates left wide open, He found everyone huddled in the largest halls together, from lords to kitchen maids and cattle besides, with piles of coal and firewood and frozen game of their own heaped in the corridors, as if they brought it in a long time ago, realizing that the world was shrinking in on them. All of them were only waiting for the winter's night to end. And as he went north, he began to believe it never would. The stories of the long night said a night that lasted for a generation. And he'd smiled at them the way he'd smiled when Ned Stark told them of the Great War come again. Sometimes he found houses where the fire had died and no one had gotten up to tend it. A silent ring of huddled corpses by a dead hearth, sometimes with firewood still heaped in a box beside it. He couldn't find any roads to follow. They were all buried under snow and ice. He rode north by the stars. For a 2-week stretch, he didn't see another living person, and he began to think the whole world was a tomb until he saw a flickering orange glow in the distance, and came, unexpectedly, to the Crossroads Inn and found it full of people, huddled and sheltering but alive, with a fire in the central hearth crackling bravely. When he came inside and found them, he sat down at a table and wept in relief, and the innkeeper even got up and gave him a small bowl of porridge, the first food he'd eaten in 2 months. Jaime ate it all, even knowing he'd vomit it up again the next morning. A month later, still going north, he saw the gleaming obelisk of Moat Cailin's high tower rearing up against the rising moon. As he rode past it, a blast of frigid air came knifing out of the north and froze the breath over his mouth and nose, so he had to take off his gloves and desperately claw his veils off with his bare hands. As soon as he had, he fumbled the fruit out of the box and took a bite, the smallest bite he could manage, out of its pockmarked side, and chewed the resistant living flesh of it with tears pouring down his face that froze into tinkling bits of ice as they ran off him and fell to the ground. The bite carried him for 2 weeks into the north. He made for Winterfell in desperate hope. Tyrion would help him. Tyrion would know what to do, how to get him out of the horrible trap. He'd think of something. He'd still be there, surely, with Sansa holding the keep, an island of life against the dark and cold. Jaime tried to convince himself that he'd get there in one more day, for 6 days in a row. And then he had to face the truth that he'd missed it somehow, in the featureless snowy wastes. He thought about turning back, trying to find it, but he couldn't do that. Go north. Those were his orders, and he had to follow them. He took another bite instead and kept going. The days blurred into one another. He didn't see another living, moving thing. Nothing except him and the silent steed, and the longer he rode it, the more he started to think it wasn't alive either. Sometimes he caught sight of it out of the corner of his eye and a hollow eye socket looked back at him, or a gleam of pale white bone. And he jerked his head around, pounding, to stare at its pale blue eyes, the curving antlers stretching up from the forehead, like the deadly crown growing out of Rob's skull. He didn't stop for the nights anymore. Whenever the stars completed one wheeling circuit around the sky, he paused long enough to make a fire and melt himself some snow and drink a cup of blood. When the cold began to pierce through his clothes, he ate another tiny bite of flesh. Then he rode onward. The steed didn't seem to mind. He'd eaten half the fruit when he saw the wall beginning to rise up on the horizon. He came to the base of it a week later, and there, at last, he did have to turn, one way or the other. He had no idea where he was. He threw a pebble with one dark side and went east because it landed up. After a day's ride, he came to one of the keeps along the wall, Oakenshield, one keep east over from Castle Black. He'd gone the wrong way. He didn't weep again, but he could have. The place was deserted, stripped bare. Everyone at the wall had converged on Castle Black for the final defense. Tyrion had told him that 1,000 years ago. Jaime desperately wanted to ride back west along the wall. Surely someone from the Night's Watch was still at Castle Black. He tried to persuade himself that he needed directions to the Grove and couldn't quite go north. So instead, as the moon rose, he climbed the wall. There were stairs and walkways crawling up the face to the top. He left his steed down at the bottom, took the box with him, and trudged the whole painful way. At the top, he had to take another bite of the fruit against the blasting cold, but beneath the pale, brilliant moonlight, he could see the snow plain stretching out northwards, the lands beyond the wall. The pure white field was almost unbroken, except by a few dark ancient treetops piercing the top of the drifts. And far in the distance, to the north, he could see one larger open cluster of treetops standing together, free of the snow that covered all the rest of the world. In the moonlight, their leaves glowed dark blood red, the only color in the world. Jaime let his eyes shut. He didn't have an excuse to go to Castle Black after all. He didn't want to climb down. He didn't want to go to that open waiting grove and make ready for the murder of his shining king, his savage lover, his innocent victim, the boy he'd condemned to slow torment and death in his father's place because he'd been too cowardly to let Eddard Stark go. He couldn't bear to see Rob looking up at him as he died on the blade of his own house. And he also couldn't bear to watch Rob ride away north to spend 1,000 years glacially becoming a monster and tombed beneath sheets of ice. He wanted to throw himself off the wall instead. He didn't even have any idea of what to do, how he could possibly defeat the king in the north, the Night's King, his king of merciless honor, inches away from becoming the monster that only honor could defeat. Jaime drew a breath slowly and stepped back from the edge. He turned around, and then he halted, his whole body stilling. He was standing on top of the wall looking south, and far in the distance, at the very farthest edge of the world in his view, the eastern sky had faded to a paler blue. There was a thin pink-orange line of color, just barely rimming the curve of the horizon. When the king reached the sea, he stopped there for a little while, hunting down the last of the rotting dead, until the last of the heavy silence of deep winter reached him, and no more of them rose. Then the work was done. And all the oaths kept, except for one, a final thread-thin silver chain still tangled around him. And when it was all that was left, he had to turn and follow it back to the north. But the journey filled the king with cold anger. Every mile he rode along it was surrender to the sun and all of the hateful and cowardly warm things squelching out of their warrens in his wake, stealing back into the world he'd cleansed, filling it back up with rot and flesh and greedy, grasping hunger. Every morning he wanted to turn around and scourge them away again, but the promise drew him onward. Even his riders began to fall away. His faithful ones turned faithless. They asked his leave, and he gave it, contemptuous. He would keep none of them with him who were not true. They climbed off their mounts and went back into the sun, and as they did, all the strength of winter came out of them, their mortal flesh shedding its silver virtue. They fell down kneeling in the stink of their own corruption, weeping. And he rode on away from them without looking back. But three, he knew, would never leave him. three who rode at his side, steadfast to the very heart of them. But even that trust was betrayed in the end by more vile mortal grasping. Only a handful of riders were still with him when at last he came back past the great keep in the north, and from within the walls four children came out, silver and bright, with four great wolves at their sides. He knew them. He would have welcomed them, but they did not want to come and ride with him. Instead, they reached for his truest riders, calling to them, "Father, John!" And a woman came forth from the keep behind them, wrapped in her furs, her face thin and pinched. She would have clutched at him, but the king drew back in disgust from the touch of mortal flesh and ordered her away. She wept and obeyed because she could do nothing else. But she looked up at the rider at his side and called him, "Ned, my love," and asked him to stay. And she had a claim upon him, a great entangling rope of an oath, and the rider bowed his head and wept. "You come no further," the king told the rider, cold in disappointment. "No," the rider said, "no, Rob, I'll not leave you." But the king recognized with hard distaste that the promise was only more mortal clinging itself, barely better than the fleshy hand trying to clutch at his legs. "Dismount," he said, an order given, and the rider could only obey. He climbed down, tears running from his face. The king looked at his other riders, all of them who remained, and commanded, "And all the rest of you who do not truly wish to come north with me." And they all climbed down, slowly, until only two were left, his silver gold knight and his dark-haired shadow, waiting to follow him to the end. But the priestess came before him and told him, "Even if they do not truly wish it, they only wish to stay with you. Will you take them with that bond to a fate they do not desire?" It made him angry, but she was not lying. "No," he said, and turned on them, and dismissed them from his service as well. But the knight clung to her steed and said grimly, "Has my service not earned me the right to keep riding with you, your grace, at least to the grove?" "And mine," the shadow said. He didn't want them. They weren't his anymore. They were only a bitter reminder that all the world was made of foul dross, and nothing silver could remain. But they had indeed earned the right. He didn't answer, only turned his steed north and rode onwards, and let them trail behind him like offal stuck onto the hooves of his steed. Their presence only made his disdain go climbing into cold rage, even before he came to the wall, and recognized the trap of it as he stood at the gates. It had been made to imprison him. Once he went through to the other side, his power would diminish greatly. He would have to flee from the sun, instead of having the power to chase it back away. If he went through. He stopped there a long time, silent and unmoving. The thin chain of silver stretched across the gates, the oath calling him onwards. He had given his word, and it was a trap, but it had not been a lie. He had been told what would be required of him. He had been warned that he would not want to return. He had made the oath knowingly. And if he broke it, that silver would go out of him wholly, and he would not be true. He finally urged on his steed and went through the gates. As soon as he did, he felt the jaws of the trap closing in on him, a terrible weight that wanted to crush all the strength and power out of him. He strained against it, refusing to give in, and he managed to hold the worst pressure off until he reached the other side of the wall and broke out into the clean, dark cold of the night again, breathing sharply. But the weight remained, and he felt the sun come leaping at his heels at once, a hound now straining at the leash to chase him down. instead of a cringing cur lurking behind him, ready to leap away. It was coming, and he rode on at once, pressing the steed to run. The miles were eaten away, riding without pause. His false servants fell behind, little by little. They tried to keep with him, but their steeds no longer obeyed them eagerly. By the time the snow began to slope quickly downwards to bare ground and he reached the edge of the great weirwoods, he was riding alone. He came through the trees still at a quick, trotting pace, their silent faces brooding around him with fresh, rising distaste. A different stink of rot, but much the same in the end, rose thick beneath the hooves and flowed off the pungent leaves until it reached the edge of the central grove and stopped. The children of the forest gathered there, 10 or 20 of them waiting inside the ring, and they had long, slender knives in their hands, blades of solid black and hilts of pale wood, ready for the carving.